Hi, this is Paul Siegel. You're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and youtube.com/wanderingdms/live. And now, on with the show. Hi, everyone. Welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan. Today on Wandering DMs, we're going to be talking about how to balance pre-generated characters, and in particular, how many magic items should they have. We'll look at classic modules, treasure tables, and real-life play. All that and more today on Wandering DMs.
Before we get into today's discussion, I will remind all our viewers that at the end of the show, we will be hosting our after-party chat. That is a live video chat that is hosted by Dan and I with all of our patrons. And you can join in by becoming a patron. Just visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. You'll get an invite link to our private Discord server. Get your account set up over there during the course of the show, and about 10 minutes after the show or so, Dan and I will be there to chat with you all live.
We love that. Hope you get on there. And thanks to Backways for checking in that we are currently live online. Appreciate that. So pre-generated characters. And we, you know, hopefully this chat is applicable to everybody. This is a common thing you want to do in your games, whether it's home or a convention or a tournament or something like that. But you may know that Paul and I have a kind of interesting, slightly unique use case that not only are we designing new adventures at the conventions that we go to, and not only are we playtesting them a day later, but we're playtesting them twice separately. And one of the things that happened when we did this at GaryCon a couple weeks ago is that we had radically different play experiences. The team that I had found the module very, very hard that we made, and Paul's group found it very, very easy, and we were trying to figure out how that occurred. And we were thinking, okay, we not only are we two different DMs, but we are using different sets of pre-generated characters. And perhaps, you know, as good scientists, and we talk about this a lot, as good scientists, perhaps we should be more closely aligned. Maybe we're not going to use exactly the same characters, but maybe they should be a little bit more balanced. And one of the things that popped out at us is that our rosters of characters had very different magic item loadouts. And that has spawned an approximately, I think, 3-week argument about whose was better, whose set of characters was more appropriate for how many magic items you should expect.
I mean, the interesting thing here, Dan, is I think, you know, as fascinating as it is that this kind of came up for us in the course of running Dungeon Design Dash, I think it's really something probably every adventure writer should be thinking about, right? Mm-hmm. Because you are, in fact, writing a D&D adventure that will potentially be run by many different groups with many different styles and many different histories, right? And the higher the level range you're targeting, the more likely you're going to get very disparate groups of adventurers with different levels of power based solely on the magic items. I mean, you can certainly, is maybe a little more discreet to think about, well, I know what level the characters are, so therefore I know what kind of, you know, what their bonuses to hit and how many spells they'll have, that sort of thing. You can certainly predict all that. But magic item distribution is partly random, right? If you assume that treasure tables are being rolled on, and partly just up to the whim of the DM, right? And the whim of other adventure writers, if you have a DM who's running a long campaign where they integrate pre-written modules from lots of different authors. And it really is very variable. I'll cut to the chase here and say, like, I think that the end of our argument here is basically, if you're writing an adventure, you must allow for a very wide range of magic item power levels, because you just can't predict.
True. And, you know, one of the things that spawned this, one of the real pain points, and Backrius has pointing that out in the chat at the moment, is that it lines up with the issue in classic D&D of some monsters can only be hit by magic items. And that's a really important threshold of if I've got a magic item, I can at least do something against it. And if I don't, I'm completely helpless against this particular monster. And for us in the last dungeon design, Dash, that was the key thing in the very first encounter is sure enough, we put one of the biggest monsters, the giant mummies, at the very entryway to the dungeon. They can only be hit by magic items. And Paul's group, everybody could do that automatically. My group, only a single person had a magic item. It was a much bigger issue. So dialing in how many people can do anything at all against those monsters that need magic items to be hit, like some of the undead, like gargoyles, like elementals, that's a really key issue about whether you're entirely impotent against a particular encounter or not. So we ought to think about that. I think that we probably can use some viewer help today in particular to help us kind of process what should happen. And I'll also point out, one of the things that's kind of urgent for you and me, Paul, is that we're going to do this again in a couple of days. So we're going to be at Rising Phoenix Game Con at the end of the week and do it all over again. And this is an opportunity for us to dial that in a little more closely.
Dan, I actually have an anecdote to share with you that also feeds into this that you're going to be totally unaware of. So here we go. Here's Paul surprises Dan last minute. Sorry about that, Dan. Not really. I think it makes for good shows. Last weekend was my annual small house con, about 20, 25 people. Dan has come every single year, I think, except this year. Is this the first one you've ever missed?
I think so.
It was a bummer. There was a lot of discussion about that. Yeah. Sorry to have broken your streak. Dan, unfortunately, was a little ill.
Me
unable
too.
To come. I have been, over the course, very recently decided each year at one of these, I was going to run one of our dungeon design dashes because I want to have run them all. I don't like having stuff out there, honestly, that I've published that I've never run. So this year was WDM03, which was the Desolate Sanctum of the Flying Lich. I don't know if you remember this one, Dan, but it's our high level one, right? So I dusted off my level 7 to 9 batch of characters and I threw them in there. And there's not a lot of combat encounters in this particular one. There's a handful of them.
Yep.
But the major one is there's a series of puzzles where there are these golems that you have to pass, and they're a little puzzly. There's a secret, clever way if you get the right clue to bypass them. But if not, you have to fight them. And I don't know if you remember this, Dan, but they require +2 or better weapons to hit.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So in my pile of 12 pre-generated level 7 to 9 characters, how many 2 weapons do you think I had?
Well, if we use like the randomizer, I would maybe around two in a party.
It was very close. There was one. There was exactly one character with a +2 weapon.
There you go.
Fortunately, the party did select that character. As you know, in these, when I run these games,
yes,
I have
dozens
of characters. That's more than players, and I always give them the premise of, well, if anybody dies before like the halfway mark or something, we'll just have them bring in a new character so that you don't have to sit out half the game. Or if we get a TPK halfway through the game, we'll send in the B team. So I like to have more characters than that. So like, it was very lucky in this case that they managed to bring that one character with them. But it got me thinking, maybe should we as designers have put somewhere in this adventure as treasure a +2 weapon?
Interesting. Perhaps so. Maybe so. Yeah,
that's I'm kind of inclined to do that. And I think it'd be a very easy fix and something that we can discuss down the road. But looking at it on the fly as I was running it, the thought definitely occurred to me, there's a place where there's actually a +1 sword with locate object ability on it. I was like, that could easily just be a +2 sword. And that would probably be wise. Right. And then likewise, as we go back to the one that we ran at GaryCon, I think we've also discussed this of should there be a magic weapon somewhere in there, so if the party starts getting slammed by the mummies in the first encounter, then the instinct of that one player to go, I'm gonna run inside because maybe there's something in there to help me, the answer is actually maybe yes, maybe he's right,
maybe
I don't know.
I may have a little bit of a blind spot about, you know, using, about taking opportunities like that to pepper useful items into the dungeon before the horrible thing happens. I actually may not do that enough. That's kind of an interesting element that maybe we should start adding. Is not bad.
And it's interesting to contemplate whether it happens before or after. Because of course, in the case I was talking about with Desolate Lich,
yeah,
it is certainly very easy for that to happen before, or at least it's did you choose to go left or right, so there's a chance for it to be before. Whereas with the mummies, it would be decidedly after.
Right. That's interesting.
Is that good or bad? I don't know.
I think there's a bit of a trope in Gygaxian adventures that the item that would have been useful against a monster is in that monster's treasure. So you fight a dragon, and inevitably in the dragon's hoard, there's a potion of fire resistance or dragon control or something like that. It happens over and over and over again, which is kind of a funny Gygax screw you. I don't hate it
because it does reward the clever lateral thinking player who says, I'm gonna cast detect magic and start searching the church or see if there's something to help, right?
I was also gonna say
it would be funny to fight something that requires +2 weapons to hit that is itself wielding a +2 weapon. Right? That's true. Funny. I would enjoy that of like, okay, well, maybe you got to just disarm the thing and use its own weapon against it. I don't know.
And it's also kind of funny of like the dragon intentionally is hoarding a potion of dragon control either to protect itself or to like use against another rival dragon, perhaps. That's actually not an entirely crazy motivation, right?
Yeah. I don't hate any of these ideas.
Yeah, I know. Right? They're really not terrible. So maybe just to begin with on this question, we could look at what the earliest books literally say the chances for magic items should be for characters of particular levels. And this can be fairly quick, but I have the first image with the red dot is going to be from original D&D, 1974, Little Brown Books. And if you look in the monster section, the very first monster is men, of course. Starting with bandits, but these rules apply for everybody that comes afterwards. And for your leader types, which could be of practically any level, basically it says that in a couple different categories, for example, for fighters, you're going to check for an armor, for a shield, for a sword. And for each of those things, they have a 5% chance per level to have a magic item. So if I'm 6th level, I've got a 30% chance for each of these three different categories, and just the chances are the same, but the categories are different for magic users or clerics. I think we all agree that for the purposes of PCs, that's low, right? And that exact same rule was carried forward into an advanced D&D. It shows up the exact same way in the monster manual. And maybe for NPCs, that's reasonable, but I think almost all of us would agree that that's low for player characters. Am I right about that, Paul?
I agree.
So we could go forward.
In prep for today's discussion, we can bring this in later. I did go back and dig up my own character generator, my own, which was originally a BX character generator, but I eventually adapted it to OED, which is available on my blog, paulsgameblog.com. You can find it there under the tools menu. There's a character generator. So I looked up the math for how that assigns magic items to characters, and this or at least the algorithm of what's being executed here, pretty similar.
Okay. And I'll talk about my OED rule in just a bit.
So if we go forward to the
orange dot image, you go forward to the advanced, and this is very small, I apologize. So this is the advanced D&D first edition DM's guide. Way, way at the back has an appendix P on creating a party. And specifically the use case is Gygax saying, oh, you're at a convention. You don't have pre-made characters. You're in kind of an emergency. How are you going to make characters of an appropriate level for your convention adventure? And here you've got a table for your defensive item and your weapon. And more or less, it boils down to 10% per level. And for what it's worth, the player has to pick one of these character categories. You only get one single role. And the best option there is to pick one of the categories where it's 10% per level. So double what they've got the NPCs set up. And if you're sixth level now, it's 60% likely that you'll have a magic sword or a magic shield or something like that.
Just one magic item.
Well, you get to roll, like the NPCs, you get a roll for one of the types of armor. You get a roll for one of the types of weapons. So you'll have one shot at armor, one shot at a weapon, and there's going to be one shot for something else as well. So basically double chances. If I'm fourth level, 40% chance for a magic sword. I think that's more in the ballpark. Now, for what it's worth, what I settled on, what I currently have written in our OED house rules is I have a 1 in 6 chance per level, which is a little bit more convenient to roll. It works out pretty closely to 15% per level. So it's another step up past the DMG. The additional interesting thing that I thought was you're going to roll a fistful of D6s, and every one that shows up, you get an extra +1. So in addition, like all those rules were basically just, you get a +1 weapon, that's it, the end. But by rolling my bunch of D6s, you might actually get a +2 or maybe a +3 weapon, which is kind of interesting.
How many categories are you rolling for? Is it just one roll, or are you like, it sounds like in AD&D it was 3 checks, you got an armor and a weapon and a something else.
I try to keep it very close to that. I make it 4. So if you're a fighter, you get to roll for a weapon. You get to roll for an armor. I think you get to roll for a potion, like maybe a healing potion, and then a miscellaneous category, which could be a weapon or something else, or a ring or something else.
So I want to share with you what's going on in my own OED character generator online, because it is so close. It is so similar. although in my case, because it's driven by code, it's allowed to be a little more complex. But essentially what's happening is I'm giving 6 roles. There are 6 categories.
Okay.
And then each role is 10% per level.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting.
And then what you're rolling on varies very much based on what kind of character it's rolling. What are their class levels, right? Or what is their highest class level, right? So it varies, not just like, it doesn't just assume you're a fighter or a magic. You might be a fighter magic user, right? You might be a level 4 fighter 2 magic user, something like that, right? So it jimmies kind of what exactly tables we're rolling on. But generally, the code is such that if you're rolling a straight fighter, you're going to get 1 armor, 1 shield, maybe 2 weapon rolls, and then 2 other things that are maybe like a potion or something like that.
Right.
And then magic users aren't going to get all that, right? Magic users are going to get maybe a weapon and then 5 other things, but there's a bunch of like wands and scrolls and that sort of thing. And this is why you'll see, and I know you know this, Dan, from having looked at my own characters, the thieves are the most unusual, because the thief gets 1 armor. Maybe they'll get some leather, magic leather armor, maybe not. Right. Or a ring of protection, something like that. They'll get 1 possible weapon, and then they get 4 on miscellaneous magic. So my thieves end up with the largest quantity of weird stuff. And partly this is just from my own logicking of how a party dynamic works, right? So if you have a big group of players, I do think that not only do they find different random treasure, but they will optimize the party by trading with each other. At least that's my experience with my play.
Yeah.
We find a magic +2 sword, you can bet for sure we're going to give it to our heaviest duty fighter, right? And if we find a magic scroll, for sure that's going to the magic user, which means the weird stuff always ends up in the hands of the thieves. It's just the way it works. They always end up with the weird stuff. Nice. And I kind of like that. So there you go.
I agree. And, thieves at the outset were a little bit of a gimp class, a little bit. So it's not the worst thing to kind of fill in having more options with a bunch of weird stuff. So I can kind of see that as kind of attractive, actually. That's kind of nice.
Okay. I want to bring us now to talk about like some hard probability stuff.
I'm sorry. I apologize. Let me just butt in here. I want to mention the math that you mentioned. So My chances are about 15%. Yours are about 10. I have 4 categories. You have 6. So it's interesting that you have 50% more categories and I have 50% more probability. So in total expectation, our numbers work out exactly the same.
Of course they do. And yet in practice, my characters had a lot more magic than yours did, which is maybe just how probability works, right? And this is the point I wanted to make. So the funny thing is, right, I tell this story often of like having to like, you know, in my day job as a video game designer, having to beat over the heads of my design partners how probability really works. I remember working on a spawn camp system for an MMO, right? So we had like, here's this big forest and we want to spawn goblins in it. And I'm told by the designers, we want you to implement a system where it randomly populates the forest with goblins. And so just, you know, randomly pick spots within this big region and drop a goblin there. And I said, do you really mean random? And they said, yes. And I said, okay, so if we're going to spawn 10 goblins, it's okay if all 10 appear exactly in the bottom left corner, right? And they're like, no, I want them to be random. Well, that's a random, that's in the world of random, that is a possibility. And I said, "What? If that's not what you want, maybe what you really want to ask for is even distribution. And so maybe we really need to subdivide the forest into 10 sections and then randomize within each section where the goblin goes. And then you'll get nice sprinkled about the forest random goblins." And that's usually typically what they're actually after.
In my own
system, right? Let me point this out, right? In my own system, if you're playing a level 1 character, let's say, you have a 10% per level chance and you get 6 rolls. Possible outcomes. You could end up with a level 1 character with 6 magic items. Right. Also possible outcomes. You could end up with a level 10 character with 0 magic items. Both are possible.
I feel like recently, in the last couple of weeks, I heard someone talking about current computer game design principles. And I think they were saying something along the lines of games that have like some kind of damage component. I could be misremembering, but it was like games that have some kind of damage component based on dice. By default, you're going to run it multiple times and take the average of the results. And that if you actually have a straight D8 roll or something like that, the players now get really bewildered by the high variation you get. And boy, that was like a dagger in my heart, because I feel like if that's true and people's intuitions are getting even more fraudulently formed around how random numbers and dice work, I'm not happy about that level of misinformation being in the world. But moving on. And now I will say that one thing with our roster of characters is that Paul tuned his out of the generator and I did not. I embraced full randomness and Paul did a little bit of tuning. And I, at the bare minimum, I'm convinced now that I should be doing more tuning on my character for a couple different reasons. I wasn't doing that in the past. So that's probably one
thing. When you say tuning, do you mean that like what charts am I rolling on based on kind of character type?
No, I mean, I'm talking about making manual changes after the fact.
Oh, manual.
After it comes out of the generator. And as one example, I'll say, and thanks to everybody for the conversation 2 weeks ago, I do think, so previously, I guess I was amused by having some of the characters more powerful and some of them clearly weaker. And amused at, is anybody going to risk taking this wizard with very low hit points, but a crap ton of spells. And now I am thinking that for a convention experience, maybe it's better to have every character to be arguably viable in some way, so that the first person to pick doesn't have a completely better play experience. So maybe I need to commit to having them a little bit more balanced, and any one of them is arguably interesting in some way. I wasn't
that is
doing
interesting.
That before.
You know, the other thing I fear is in my own presentation of like, hey, don't worry, guys, if we have a TPK in hour 2, because I have a bunch of characters, we'll just send in the B team. My fear is, what if the B team is markedly worse than the A team because we chose all the best characters for the A team?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. There's that. There's that.
No, and that's it's like, interesting. Oh, we're really behind the eight ball. Yeah.
It's interesting in your playtest, in your playtest last week, Paul, that you ran the exact same issue that I was having at GaryCon, that you were fighting monsters and there was only one character at the table with the right magic item that could possibly hit it. That's exactly the problem that I had with the mummies. And in retrospect, it's very possible that the players didn't even pick that character and we would have been in a situation where nobody could have possibly hit it. Yep. And that's not great. Yep. So,
yeah. Now I do like in both cases, in our adventure design, in both cases, we gave here's a way for you to get past this monster without fighting it at all. And I like that we included that. But I feel like I also want to include, also, here is a weapon hiding somewhere in treasure somewhere that will help you fight this thing if that becomes necessary.
The fighting should be an option.
Yeah. Now, for what it's worth, and this is the part that I did that will make Dan absolutely cringe, is that as we were in that fight, and I started to realize all of this was happening live going on, I decided, you know what?
Oh, no.
The sword that was in the treasure, it is a they didn't know. They knew it was magic. They're like, I don't know, it's a magic sword. Well, I don't know what it is, right? And I'm like, okay, you know what? It is. Now I had two out of eight characters could actually damage the thing.
All right, I'll forgive that this time. That's fine. That's fine.
Well, you know, it's an edit that I frankly, if we go back, I don't know if we're ever going to do this, but if we ever went back to edit that module, I would encourage us to make that change. Go ahead and change that.
Let's do it. I'm convinced.
You know,
it's good.
And the other thing that struck me is like, it's as written, it's a +1 sword locate object, and my brain immediately jumped to: are they going to know it's a locate object sword? How are they going to figure that one out?
Right.
Like that's a weird effect to attempt with your sword. So I mean, this great. It's great for campaign play. You know, that's a great item to give out. But in a convention game, it's sort of like the opposite of the mummy rod effect, right? Like mummy rod is a terrible, horrible thing in campaign play, and in convention, who cares? Ignore it.
You know, I think, wasn't there, I mean, let's, we don't have time to look at it. I have this vague recollection that when we placed the locate object sword, there was like, they can use this to figure out where the blah is.
Maybe the phylactery. It might be the phylactery that you're thinking of.
Yeah.
Yeah. Of course, my players had a character who had a locate object spell on them, and that's exactly what they did. Right.
Okay. And I'll say that was also the key thing to win the GaryCon AD&D tournament. Also, just as a complete separate side, people were using that were the ones that were good in the high score. Anyway, maybe perhaps what'll solve our problem is we should look at the pre-generated characters in some of those early classic modules.
Yes,
and
yes,
the great thing there is
we both did this.
Not only are they early adventures, but those adventures were run in tournament form at conventions originally. So this is exactly the situation that they were in. And for both Paul and I, when we were doing this, the very first thing that we thought of was the A series, the Against the Slavers series that we both run. There's a very nice set of characters that are consistent all through that series as the tournament adventure. And I have them lined up in the yellow dot image. So 9 characters. And for those kinds of tournaments still today, right? So this is in the 70s, you expect 9 players, 9 characters, no more, no less. That's what the adventure is set up to be. The AD&D tournament that I was one of the referees at GaryCon, still exact same thing, 9 players, 9 characters. These 9 characters is what's going to show up. And they're all level 5 or 6. And looking at this particular roster, that third column there, every single character has exactly 2 magic items. I guess there's 1 with 3. There's 1 with an extra potion for what's worth. But other than that, everybody's got 2 magic items. And Paul was the one who observed, I didn't notice this, but observed that every single fighter has a magic weapon. Some of them are expendable, like one of them has magic arrows. But every single fighter has a magic weapon. The non-fighters don't.
And you also have somebody carrying javelins of piercing. But yes, and my argument is in a convention game, the difference between a magic melee weapon and magic ammunition is null. That basically because you're in a convention game, use it or lose it, right? Having 10 plus one arrows, or I guess in this case, 8 plus two arrows, is just as good as having a plus one sword. In fact, better. Because A, it's plus two, and B, I can fire them at range, so I don't have to be right next to the dangerous thing. They're just better.
Good argument. I'm convinced. That's a solid argument. Mostly they're plus one. There's two plus twos in the mix here. So those arrows are plus two, and then Alwida at the top is a plus two Warhammer. Everybody else is plus one. So that was an interesting. Note: the fighters have magic weapons, and the other people don't. So that looks very intentionally designed to my eye. Interesting.
I think so. Now, yeah. I'm trying to remember, are there monsters in the A series that can only be hit by magic weapons? Is that even
somewhere
a concern?
I'm sure there are. There's going to be gargoyles or margoyles somewhere in there. So it's at some point, definitely. Okay. Yeah. Now, I don't have images for every single one of these things. The next thing that I looked at is Tomb of Horrors. Tomb of Horrors actually has a really big roster of PCs, actually 20. It's not this. So 20, again, I don't have this as an image. Tomb of Horrors has a list of 20 PCs, and depending on how many players show up, the DM can mix and match which ones get used. What crazy wide level range from level 6 to 14, but despite that, every single one of them almost always has four items.
Huh. Okay.
Almost exactly four items, whether you're level 6 or 14, you're in between four items, and 19 out of the 20 have a magic weapon. There's one single wizard that doesn't. I almost wonder if that's a typo. wide variation. Right, from plus one to plus three, but every single one of those from level six up has a magic weapon, but just four. There's part of me that doesn't mind having a small number that's easy to parse for the player.
Yeah, for this exercise, I really wanted to find stuff that was in the middle range of levels, because I thought that was more likely to see something. Agreed. Where you're going to see some, Agreed. But not all, or an interesting split. The next adventure I looked at, which I also don't have an image for, apologies, was Ed Greenwood's Into the Forgotten Realms, which I remember from being in the second edition Forgotten Realms box set, but I think it was originally published in a copy of Dragon Magazine. It was a tournament module. It included, I think, 9 player characters, 9 pre-gens of levels 6 to 8, right? So right there in the sweet spot. And they had 0 magic items, not a one amongst any of them. No magic items whatsoever.
Wow.
And I am consistently surprised. Every time I discover this, I swear this is not the first time I've stumbled into that fact, but I always forget it. And then when I look, I go, wait, what? Because there's no mention of it anywhere. It's never, it's not called out in the background of the adventure as being relevant in any way. It's definitely, it's set in the Forgotten Realms. We're exploring the ruins of Mithranor. We're exploring the old school of wizardry. There are magic items in the treasure. Why don't the characters have any magic items? I almost, every time I look at it, I think, this is an error. Somebody screwed up.
I feel like that's a design oversight. And I mean, there's a world where those super old school original DMs would say, if you didn't adventure it, you didn't earn it. You don't get any magic items if you didn't adventure from level one up.
Choice, I would expect there to be some mention of it in the text somewhere.
Agreed.
And it just isn't. Agreed. And I'm utterly bewildered by that. So that was my second one. I looked at that one and I went, okay, this just doesn't make sense.
I looked at the C series of modules. Is the C is supposed to be for the competition series of things that were specifically convention tournaments. And I looked at the first one, Lashern of Tam O'Aken. And the PCs there have a very small number of items, like same levels, very small number of items, 2 items each, no magic weapons, no magic armor. But the context for that is that we're lost in a tropical jungle. We've lost most of our stuff. We're on our last legs and we're kind of in desperate straits. So thematically, we shouldn't count that because that seems to be set up differently.
I mean, interestingly, right, you can also point to the final module of the A series, right, where you've got these characters, you've been using them through the whole sequence.
Yes, true.
And then in the very last one, you're like, all your gear is gone. True. Everything is gone.
True. True.
Which is just an amusing and entertaining setup. And I remember the one time I played that at a convention, the first thing that happened is all the wizards got pushed to the front line because statistically they have the highest dexterities and therefore the lowest armor classes of the group.
That's funny. Yep. Let's look at one other thing. Now, this is the one with the green dot, and this is one of the earliest ones that I saw. This is from Gary Gygax's, and it's, sorry, this is too small for anybody to read. So, but this is from Gary Gygax's Descent into the Depths series, the D123 series. Again, consistent characters all the way through. Nine. The number shall be nine players and characters.
Nine.
And this is the set that has these very fascinating names that have entertained people for years, like Funk and Hottie Peak and folks like that. And so here the levels are 7 to 12 each. And if you look at that second to last column, they have a gobsmacking shipload of magic items. From 5 to 9 each. They most of them have like 7 magic items. They have an armor and a shield and a weapon and a secondary weapon and a miscellaneous thing and a scroll. And every single one of them have 3 extra healing potions at the end. But even ignoring that, they have just a gobsmacking number of magic weapons. Every single one on this list, okay, there's 9 characters. Every single one on this list has a magic sword, except for the one cleric. Any of the characters all have magic swords. No spear, no hammer, no nothing else. And remember, at the very earliest thing we looked at, original D&D, the men list, is you can roll for an armor and a shield and a sword. That's it.
Yeah.
Right? Sword, not an axe, not a spear, right? It's you have a sword or you have no magic weapon whatsoever. And that's exactly what they did here in this very early module is if we're going to roll you for a sword, we're going to assume you have a magic sword, nothing else really matters. So that's exactly what they do here. Commonly, it's +1 or +2 here at these levels, around 9 or 10 or 12. There's a single 14th level. There's a single +3 sword here.
Right. So here's my question, Dan. Having looked at all of these historical data, is there anything of value to learn here other than just they were all over the map and they did whatever the hell they wanted?
I think that I think the best thing is like it gives it like how do these different things give us like feel in for, like, how do these things different have different taste to us? I think the A series looks very intentionally designed, very well thought out. I think that those D characters, I don't want to deal with that much stuff. I like as a DM, I'm going to have an oversight someplace. There's going to be something that's overpowered that I don't have time to assess. The player, it's going to take us more time at the outset for the players to parse what their options are. That's just way too much stuff to just, I don't want to read all that, frankly. So I think based on those things, I don't mind the Tomb of Horrors idea of like maybe 4. And this idea in the A series of like the fighters at that level should have a magic weapon and maybe other people shouldn't. That seems like a really clever kind of design choice.
You know, I like the A series distribution, like the numbers. Like usually my gut in that level starts to think like, I don't know, you should have like maybe half your level in total items, give or take.
Right.
And I do like when you're in that kind of sweet spot of levels 4 to 7. I do like that maybe not the whole party has magic weapons, but there are some, right?
Right.
I agree. Little bit of a split. That, now we get into the hand tuning part, right? Because just pure randomness alone will not get us what I'm after. Right? Your randomness will get you accidental nonsense like none of them have magic items or all of them have magic items or, you know, nobody has a magic weapon of any kind or, right? It's just too out there.
Can I throw one other example up?
Yeah.
So for the convention that I had to drop out of, unfortunately, and I almost think you might have been signed up for this, I was preparing module C2, the Ghost Tower of Inverness, and they take a very interesting different take on this. There's 5 player characters you're supposed to come into with, and on the character sheets, they have no magic items whatsoever. And what they do in that is that you're brought in to the Duke, right? And the Duke says, thank you for accepting this mission. And you're going to go to the Ducal Armory, which I have shown in the image with the blue dot. Go in the Ducal Armory, and I am provisioning you with 25,000 gold pieces in value. And you, party, can use that on whatever items are listed in the Ducal Armory. So as a party, you can pick a whole bunch of low-level stuff, or like maybe the 2,000 gold pieces for a whole bunch of sword plus ones, or maybe you want to invest 10,000 out of your 25 total into a sword plus four. And you can pick potions, you can pick scrolls, you can pick armor, and it's up to you, players. You decide what your loadout should be based on the prices. I'm not super thrilled about that.
Dan, I hate it for many reasons.
Me too. We agree. Okay, for me, reason number one, it could potentially take a very long time. And I've had games entirely go totally awry. Particularly if there's a friggin' debate. If there's an impasse in two players fundamentally disagreeing, this could be a four-hour argument, among other things, right?
Easily lose half of your time, your convention game time.
If one of my brothers, one of my autistic brothers or sisters is compelled, as I would be, to make a completely comprehensive assessment in a spreadsheet of the pros and cons of all these different things and what the investment value is, that's going to take a long time and not be super great for anybody. And the third thing, Paul, I don't trust any of the pricing, right? All this stuff comes to the DM's guide and Gary was just making it up. There's no formula. There's no system. He was just making it up by intuition. And I don't trust any of the valuations. And it brings us back to our common thesis that I have. And that is that point buy systems are always inherently broken. And that's exactly what you have right here. And so I agree. Yep. I don't like this for multiple reasons. Get it out of my face. I don't want to see it anymore. That's kind of how third edition did everything, right? If you remember, third edition had magic items are fungible. You can sell them. You can buy new stuff anytime you want. And that's actually how you constructed your PCs all the time in third edition by gold piece price value. Blech.
You said you were preparing to run this, Dan. What were you going to do? Were you actually going to give them the sheet and say, well, it says that I'm supposed to do this?
I was.
You were just going to just aim that pistol right at your foot. Here you go, everybody. The rules.
Well, I looked at my list of players. I only had three, so the communication is better. I think you were one of them, and I was gonna I'm gonna trust my players. We're gonna experience this once.
Yeah, I would be. I might be inclined. I guess what I would do is, if I was running this, here's options for you, for any players out there who's preparing Ghosts of Inverness. What I would do is, one, if you're at like a small convention like ours, email them ahead of time, communicate with them ahead of time and be like, here you go, guys, this is how this is going to work. You have a week. Pour over the list. Do whatever you want. Come prepared, because you know, the Ducal Armory closes the moment the adventure starts.
Great. I have a counter argument to that. And here it is.
Yeah,
we were playing third edition and my roommate, actually, who's a great guy, was given the standard third edition rules, your eighth level or whatever, you have this much money, what items in the book do you want to buy? And he spent 2 days making spreadsheets out of that. He pumped every item in the entire game in a spreadsheet. And I felt really bad having triggered this activity of needing to comprehensively evaluate all the pros and cons. And I kind of wouldn't want to trigger that on people, frankly.
I mean, option number two, throw it out, Dan. Just throw it out. Just make pre-gen characters and give them magic. If you must, you as DM could go through the Ducal Armory and spec out the characters using that if you feel compelled to include the actual items from the module in there. But do it for them. Do not let the players do this. Do not let them engage in this activity.
This might be happening at HelgaCon next year. Just so you're aware.
All right. Well, I'm going to make a strong argument for 2+4 swords. Done and done. Let's go.
What?
Wait, I guess we have 5,000 left. What can I spend 5,000 on? And a ring of feather fall.
Okay.
There you go. 2+4 swords and a ring of feather fall. We're done. We're leaving.
Okay. Counter argument.
Yeah.
Oh, it's on the other side. I'm sorry. I think that they've got, I think they've got potions of healing at, I think, 250. So counter argument, buy 100 potions of healing.
Great, love it.
Was the thought that came to me.
We split the difference, 1+4 sword, and then all potions. Uh-huh.
Right, there you go. Okay, that's just reasonable.
Okay. Where does this leave us, Dan? What advice do we have for DMs dealing with this? Or more importantly, who are we addressing here? Because I think the more interesting question is to fellow adventure writers, ourselves included, when we do the next dungeon design dash. How do we handle this?
I don't think that we're terribly off the mark. I think that I should follow you in manually tuning the characters more. Frankly, sometimes I'm time limited, but not entirely just randomly generate and run with it, but inspect it as you've done, give it a little bit more thought. I love how the texture of the A-series characters feels. That has clearly got a bunch of intentional design behind it. So just for starters, manually tune it more. And I think some of us in the chat agree, have all the characters in the roster a little bit more legitimate options. And then like your issue of like the B team coming in isn't underpowered either. So I think for a convention game, that is a good second stage to use.
You know, for my own characters, a couple of things that I did is, if you are using a random generator, especially software random generator, great. Mm-hmm. Generate double or triple what you need and throw a lot away. Just throw a lot away, right? And end up with the good ones. In terms of like hand tuning them, then the other thing I like to do is I have a stable of characters. I have a dozen characters and they're the same characters. Over and over and over again. I use them for every adventure, every D&D adventure I run at conventions these days. So the nice thing about that is one, it separates me from accidentally gaming the adventure, right? I'm looking at their magic items with blinders full on of just like, what would be cool for this character and not thinking about how is it going to impact their performance in this particular encounter, this particular adventure. And then the other thing I did was I generated them all at the highest level range that I do, which is 7 to 9. And then I backtracked them. And I said, okay, what did they look like at level 7, at level 5, at level 3, at level 2, right? And each time I looked at their magic items, I went, well, did they find that thing yet? Right? And I started crossing stuff off. Or maybe they had a potion early on and they used it at some point, so maybe I'll give them an extra potion. That kind of stuff. It's nice. It gives them a consistent feel. So players who play these things with me over and over again, they're like, oh, yeah, this character, that's amazing, right? And oh, yeah, I remember this.
And to be clear, they're at different levels, right? So Paul's roster is consistent across levels. So he's got versions at level 2, 4, 6, 8, and so forth of the same person.
Of the same character. Yep. So it's very interesting. At level 8, two of them have intelligent swords. And I keep tuning them, right? Every time I go out, like I look at each adventure, each time I run a campaign or a convention game with them, I come back afterwards and I look at them and go, well, were there any problems? Should I correct something on the character sheet based on that the feedback from that adventure? And I did, honestly, after this one, after Gary Condan, I did go back and look at them at level 4 to 7 and go, yeah, okay, maybe they got a little too much. Let's trim the fat a little bit.
Okay, nice, okay.
And actually, at that point, that was the time when I decided, you know what would be really interesting is if at this level, only one of the intelligent swords is in the game. So I realized I had accidentally layered both intelligent swords in at the same level. And I went, you know what?
Yes.
More interesting if there's a point where there's only one of those.
I think that's an easy mistake to make, is I wouldn't want every single character in the roster to all get a +1 weapon at the exact same level. You never get the interesting play of we need to swap it around to optimize our current party.
I also have a case. I have one point where one of the fighters who is specifically geared towards being a big, heavy, I think they're a berserker. They have a two-handed weapon. Mm-hmm. At one of the levels, they have a +1 hand axe. That is the magic item they have. And I feel like that is representative of what I see in games, right? A lot of times, like, well, we don't have a lot of magic weapons yet, but we got this +1 hand axe. We should give it to our best fighter, even though they don't want to use it most of the time. Right? But when it's clutch for them to have a magic weapon, they've got it.
Yes. Yep, that's smart. That's smart. Yeah. I agree. And likewise with the A-series characters, you know, because you asked, like, are there monsters here that need a magic white weapon to hit? It's like, well, we got it covered, right? We got it. If that comes up, we got it covered. And then it makes the design a little bit easier on the DM of, like, I don't need to worry about that specific thing. So if I drop in magic to hit monster now, the fighters can attack it and the thieves and the wizards can't. And it'll be okay. So I think that kind of coverage is smart.
Yeah. And then to go back to what we were talking about at the beginning of the show, I like the idea of doing the inverse when we're writing an adventure and don't necessarily know what the characters are going to be. If you have a gate, right? If you have you must have a +2 weapon to fight this monster, chuck a +2 weapon in the treasure somewhere. Although now I'm wondering, Dan, here's an interesting thing. I don't know how much you remember the Flying Lich Dungeon Design Dash, but the secret is there's, and spoilers, not that any, whatever, we spoiled the crap out of it when we invented it live on the show.
Right.
There's a series of like 3 different or 4 different golems you have to get past, and they're really tough fighters. They're really difficult to beat, but you could beat them in melee combat. But also each one of them has, like, if you cast this one spell on them, it kind of disables them. Should there be like scrolls kicking around or magic items kicking around that give you access to those particular spells?
Well, that's interesting. It's a super high level adventure. Our friend, let me throw up a piece of chat from earlier in the show. So our good friend, Direct Sun, said earlier that, maybe not in convention form, when you've got larger dungeons, groups can come back later and solve their problems later, right? So if you had, and now he said that originally in the context of if there's a monster, you need a magic item, you don't have it currently, that can be a really interesting campaign element. It's like, okay, we'll keep that in mind, we'll find a magic weapon, that itself can be an adventure, and then we'll come back and get by it. And so with the Flying Lich adventure, I was kind of thinking it's pretty likely that the characters are going to have this spell, and if not, they can surely go back and prepare it and get through the next time. So I'd kind of lean towards not every single one of those 3 puzzles to have a drop specifically on that. I could be wrong. I like the +2 sword. Maybe not every single spell to get past the trap.
Here, let me run by you what actually happened in my game. We have not enough time left for this, but here's what happened. The very first golem, you need like a fireball, right? To get to disable them. I have 2 wizards in my stack of 12 who have access to fireball. They brought none of them. Right.
Oh, really?
I don't even. Yeah. Yeah. So they show up. They talk. They hear the poem. They think, oh, maybe that's fire. We don't have any fire spells. So they decide, you know what we're going to do? We're going to cast invisibility 10-foot radius and we're going to sneak past it.
Oh, all right.
And then I had to go. Does that work?
Yeah.
He's got like all this like immunities to spells, but it doesn't say anything about he can see invisible.
I invite you to watch the earlier show where we asked this question to Luke Gygax, right? This has been a common sticking point in my games because there was a time where I was saying no to that, frankly. We asked Luke in one of the interviews and he said, oh yeah, that's totally how we would play it. So now based on that, I say, yeah.
Yeah, sneak right past. Great.
Great. Clever.
Which is exactly
it would not be an insane ruling to say no. Like I used to say no, frankly. It's not a crazy ruling.
I did make them make a roll to see if they made any noise. And good. They failed that roll. And the golem made a random swing and clipped one of them as they snuck past. And then they continued on their way.
Great.
And all in all, I was like, yeah, feel pretty good about that.
Could they get by all of them that way? Could they just sneak by every single one of them that way?
No. Again, in this particular case, that is exactly what they did, and I allowed it. And the reason I allowed it was we were almost out of time. And so I was like, you know what? Not putting that much thought into it for the sake of pacing of this adventure that we're playing right now. It works.
I respect that. That's an important issue.
They had the Spectre with them, so I was like, there's going to be a fun fight at the top. So it's all good. It's all good. Yep.
Clever. Clever. Well, okay.
But that was, that was, again, yeah, it was definitely me rolling with the punches in that particular one. Like, I don't know.
I might flip around the note. Okay, get okay. In the when we get to the after chat in about 20 minutes, I might at that point have flipped around a no. So check in then.
Well, if I had if pacing had not been an issue, I would have made them make rolls for noise. They eventually probably would have failed one of those rolls and got detected. And then at that point, I would have just been like, oh, make a swipe, and then they sneak past and the end. I would have been like, no, no, he heard something. He's coming to find out. Now we're pinchered by golems on either side because they hear us. Oh. they don't see us, but they hear us, right? Now we're in an interesting combat-ish situation of like, oh, there are golems just flailing about up and down the hallway, and we're trying to sneak past invisibly. I think that's a fun, that sounds like a fun encounter.
I like that. Yeah. I like that. Interesting. Interesting.
So anyway, that's neither here nor there. Yeah, interesting. One of my sort of final thoughts here is like maybe it would be interesting to publish my convention character somewhere for all to pore over and dissect. I wonder if that would be interesting. Yeah. Patrons, if you think that's interesting, drop me a note in the Discord there, and let's talk about it. If that's something people find interesting, maybe I'll do that. Whether or not they're cool characters or not.
Yeah, absolutely.
Dan, any final thoughts on assigning magic items to pre-gens for convention games or otherwise?
I'm really glad that we're getting a chance to actually think this through. We had not ever thought to coordinate the characters we're using. I mean, I actually think that at GaryCon was the first time we'd actually done the two playtests in parallel at the same time to even kind of think to converse about this. So we hadn't coordinated the characters before. I think that Paul was ahead of me in being thoughtful and tuning it and having a standard roster throughout the levels. So I'm gonna say that Paul's doing better than I was on this level, and yeah, particularly if you're doing it at a convention, and even more if you're doing it in a tournament format. And we're kind of like a tenth the way there, doing the same game twice. You ought to think about this in advance. You should tastefully tune the characters. The A series is a pretty good example of that, actually, and try to make all the characters at least legitimate at the table and have nobody entirely gimped. And I think we agree, you know, like we said, the math of our expectations is exactly the same, actually. So I think I agree that the current OED rule of 1 in 6 per level, and again, for NPCs, the rule was always 5%. In the DMG for pre-gens, it's 10%, and our rule basically works out to 15%. I think that's about right. I think at fourth level, you're about 50-50 to have an item in any one of those categories. I don't want to pump it any higher than that. So I think I'm going to stick with the OED math, but I certainly am going to be more intentional about tuning my... I'm going to have to make a new bunch of PCs for our game coming up this week, and I will definitely be more intentional about it.
I will say also I like the inverse, if I can call it that, of the math there. Of I also like the idea of at any given character level, you probably have about half your level worth of magic items, plus or minus. Right, that like a level 4 character should have 2, I guess. A level 6 character should have 3.
I might just massage it and say not every magic item is the same. I'd rather have a +3 sword than 3+1. So the raw number, like I would look at total number of bonuses, is what I would look at.
Okay, that's interesting because I do. And then when I say that, like when I look at my level 6 characters and I say they have 3 items, that's true. They might have a magic sword and a potion, right? Yeah, and I want a little bit of a spread there in terms of the power of what those items are in particular.
Yeah.
Cool. Viewers, if you have thoughts on how many magic items you expect your characters to have, especially if you have different systems or are aware of other pre-existing works of art that maybe went very differently, although I really think we covered the spectrum here in the ones that we picked. Let us know. Give us a comment here in the YouTube video. We'd love to hear from you. Maybe we'll have part two of the discussion someday.
Yeah, you know, there's a whole separate discussion we didn't get into about what do the treasure tables say to put in your dungeons versus what treasures available in the hordes of classic modules. And we have a whole, there is a whole bunch of statistics, Paul, sitting over here on my computer that we didn't even get into. So maybe that's a separate show possibly if people are interested in that part of it. But for now, remember that you can like, follow, and subscribe to us on YouTube, Twitch, Facebook, TikTok, Loops, GitHub, places like that. We have the handle Wandering DMs on all the sites. So please look for us there and divinate on that like button.
If you prefer to listen to our show in audio-only podcast format, you can do so. Those files are available on our website at wanderingdms.com. They're also available through various podcast carriers like iTunes and Spotify and Pocket Cast. If you're listening to the show right now on one of those other sites and it gives the ability to do so, please rate and review our show. That helps other users of that site find us, and we really appreciate it.
We really do. And huge thanks to our patrons who support the show. If you'd like to join them, please visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. And like we've said, every tier gets you access to our private Discord server where the conversation continues 24/7 about all. We just have the smartest, wisest patrons of all. So if you get on there and you have any questions about D&D, old school, new school, fourth edition, fifth edition, science fiction, horror games, our patrons will definitely have some of the most creative possible solutions to your problems. We'll be there in about 10 minutes for the live video after chat, and we have more things to say. And there was a bunch of great chat today. So if there's something that we missed and you want to bring to our attention, I'm really looking forward to that myself. Now, we are on most Sundays, but we're going to be off again next Sunday because, as we've said, we are traveling to Massachusetts for one of our favorite conventions every year, Rising Phoenix Game Con. We're going to be there, and we're going to do another design dash, and then we are going to do two more playtests, two more demos of whatever dungeon we come up with our newly fine-tuned, finely honed player characters and all their very specific magic items, and we're going to see whether our play experiences are more close this time as a result, or whether just because Paul and Dan are different people and whether we still have wildly different experiences to our next dungeon design dash in just a couple of days. Right, Paul?
Yep. And keep an eye on the channel because we will be trying to live stream that dungeon design dash at Rising Phoenix Game Con. I expect that to be around 7 p.m. on Friday, 7 p.m. Eastern on Friday, is give or take. We haven't quite scheduled the exact press the button show starts time yet, but that's my expectation of when that'll be. But keep an eye on the channel; that'll get announced. Come become a patron, and on our Discord server, there's a special channel where shows get announced. Or hit the little notify button there on YouTube so you get the notification when it gets scheduled.
Absolutely, we're so excited about that. So hope you'll join us for that. So we are live almost every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern time. Hope that you'll join us for the Dungeon Design Dash this Friday night, and then come back here 2 weeks from now for another thought-provoking discussion.
We'll see you then.